Hi, and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I wanted to just put a little plug in for not only the last video that I posted this week on the subject of Scientology and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I think that's a fairly important video. It's not super long, but it's got some good data in it, and the reactions and comments that I started getting to that were surprising in terms of the widespreadness of that amongst ex-members and whatnot, and some of the results and experiences that they've had in getting treatment for that or getting help with that. So I kind of wanted to throw that out there. And also put a plug in for the Sensibly Speaking podcast, which is my weekly podcast with Ruth. And also let everybody know, hey, you know, the Reason Rally is only about 2 weeks away. So coming up pretty fast. All right, so let's get on with your questions. We got a lot to cover this week, so let's get to it. Reinhard. Interestingly enough, there are still things about Scientology that are not so clear or I am completely in the dark about. For example, Sunday services. What do they do when they pretend to be a church on Sunday? When the Sunday services program came out, there was a whole program and list of things that were done. And the Sunday services are a fairly formal process. Now, I don't remember off the top of my head everything that gets done, but it is it's not a free-for-all, and it's not something that individual Scientology ministers come up with on their own. They're actually provided with, you know, with a whole format and scripts and whatnot for this. There was a big book, I mean this huge book, that very thick, that came out with the Sunday services program, which was the book of services and you know, Scientology rituals and this sort of thing. I forgot what it was called, but it was like the book of ceremonies and services and things like that, right? It was something like that. Scientology services and ceremonies and you know, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, this great big book has a number of articles in it from L. Ron Hubbard that are to be used for the sermon that they give on Sundays. And then it has this format that they follow. And it starts with an opening, right? And they, you know, they say welcome to Sunday service and that sort of thing. And they do, then they go into the L. Ron Hubbard article, right? And they basically read from it. And they, not from it, they just read the whole thing. And it could be an article about getting along with others. It could be about the ARC triangle, which is the affinity, reality, and communication triangle in Scientology, which is supposed to lead to understanding. Those three components work together to create understanding, or it could be about communication, the importance of communication, some basic Scientology principles. And there were tons of these things that were excerpted from Hubbard's works and made into these ready-made sermons, right, that were Scientology style. And so once that's read, then these specific sermons were paired up with what was called group processing. And group processing is a Scientology action where you take a group of people from 3 to, you know, 300, and you put them in a room, and you the minister, the person who's administering the group processing, gives orders and commands to the group to execute. And these are supposed to result in some kind of a spiritual awareness or awakening in the people who are being group processed. And the guy who is doing it is supposed to be trained in watching the indicators and responses of the group as a whole and taking them up to this higher state through group processing. And there would be assistance if there were a lot of people. I think for every 20 people or something like that, there's supposed to be one assistant. So if somebody is sitting there doing the commands of the group processing and, you know, gets a headache or doesn't feel good or something like that, then that person gets sort of pulled out and taken aside so they don't distract the rest of the group with their torment, right? And when this started, and I, again, when these Sunday services started, we were doing them in the Sea Org, you know, as well as all the churches, of course, were doing them, and we were encouraged to go. In fact, we had to go. So I hated group processing. I hated it. Never got really much of anything about it out of it. I just hated it. And the group processing commands are things like, they're long. There's these scripts, and they go on and on and on for pages and pages of, you know, look at the ceiling, look at the floor, look at that wall, touch your head, touch your stomach, right? Look at the floor again, right? Look at somebody next to you, say hi. You know, just these sort of objective kind of commands, right? Sometimes they would go a little subjective too, like, okay, so, you know, look at the wall behind me. Like, let's say I'm delivering the process. I'd say, okay, look at the wall behind me. Good. Now imagine it getting smaller, right? Okay, good. Now look at the ceiling. Okay, good. Now imagine it getting, you know, smaller. Look at the eight corners of the ceiling. Now be the eight corners of the ceiling. And these are not verbatim. I'm just throwing these out off the top of my head. I didn't look this stuff up before I answered this question, so I know this is all just you know what I'm remembering, but the goal of these processes was that it was somehow supposed to be connected to the subject of the sermon and was supposed to make you feel better. Okay, and that was a big part of the Sunday services, was the sermon and then the group processing. And then after the group processing, when everybody's supposed to be feeling so great, then they would do the prayer for total freedom. And I don't know where the hell they dug this thing up. I mean, I don't think Hubbard ever had anything to do with writing this. But it was this prayer, you know, to the Creator, you know, to, you know, pray for peace and goodness and this sort of thing in the world. And it was this sort of very weird thing. Like a lot of Scientologists I knew, and myself included, just thought, okay, sure, that's really spiritual, I guess, you know, because we never experienced or had anything in Scientology where you're talking to God or you're talking to a creator or praying to anyone. It's a total farce, because Scientology is not about praying. It's not about asking some higher power for a pass or for goodness or for favors or something like that. That has nothing to do with Scientology philosophy. So it really kind of got us all going, what prayer for, you know, what? Well, okay, you know, because again, you don't question too much. And anyway, so they end off with a prayer for total freedom, and then there's usually, you know, coffee and cakes or something. So for the public, not for us Sea Org members. We never got any coffee and cakes. So that's kind of the Sunday service. And we didn't really think about it much. We weren't briefed in on we were doing this because, you know, tax exemption, or we were doing this because the government was looking into us or something like that. That was never part of our thought process when we were, you know, good little Sea Org members or Scientologists doing this stuff. It was just something we were supposed to be doing. So we started doing it. And it was very unpopular. And the reason I say that and can say that is because over time, within about a year or so, you know, people stopped going. They didn't want to go. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. They thought it was a waste of time. And the Sunday service program just sort of went nowhere and just sort of, you know, kind of basically crashed and burned. And they might still promote doing Sunday services, but I think if you go to most churches of Scientology that do them, you'll find, you know, maybe a few staff, maybe a couple public, at most, if they're even doing them at all, because they're not popular amongst Scientologists. So that's the Sunday services. Lion Person. In 1997, after my second divorce, I was kind of down, and someone suggested to me to read the book Dianetics. And I just kind of looked at him, and I think I kind of shook my head no. I mean, this was a long time ago. I never read the book. I wasn't going to. Why are there people like me that can just say no? I remember in the 80s seeing all those commercials on television, and I just watched them and said, oh, well. Well, it's not like there's subliminal commands or something going on in Scientology or Dianetics promotion that somehow, you know, subvert your consciousness and free will and make you, you know, a slave to the idea that you have to go read Dianetics or something like that. If you're asking in a broader sense why, though, some people are not, in fact, a lot of people, most people, don't fall under the spell of Dianetics and Scientology, introductory services and the lines that are used, there's a number of reasons, right? One is critical thinking skills. Two is, prior education or experience with Scientology or Dianetics or similar groups. It's not trusting, groups or organized religion or anything having to do with that would be another reason somebody wouldn't be interested in it or fall in line with it. On the other hand, having very strong religious views of one's own, whether a Catholic, Christian, Jewish, like any, Muslim, whatever existing religion you have, filling that niche for you. And so you're not interested in Scientology because it's not offering you anything. Basically, what it comes down to, I think, is that there's the person who doesn't reach for it or isn't looking to it, either knows it's a scam through earlier education or knowledge, or they can see that there's something wrong here, or it simply doesn't catch with them. It doesn't. There's no appeal. There's nothing about it that appeals to that person and kind of clicks and makes them want to look into it further. And it's quite interesting how easy it can be to get it to click with somebody. Because even as a critic, I've talked with people very recently, sat down and had them ask me, what is Scientology? What is it you're doing? And they know I'm a critic. They know I don't like it. They know I think it's a money-making scam, because that's generally the first thing I say about it, right? Because I don't want anybody getting any wrong ideas about what Scientology is from me. But after I tell them what I think it really is, they go, "Well, what's the belief? What's the line?" Right? And I go, "Well, let me tell you," right? And I then go into, it's about the Thetan and the spiritual beings, and you've lived infinitely, and personal spiritual immortality and that sort of thing. And I explain. I give them the sales pitch, basically, right? And often when I do that, when I explain it that way, people are intrigued on a personal level. Like, they've told me, "Wow, that is really interesting. I want to know more about that." And then I look at them and I go, "You do realize that what I'm telling you is a total sham, right?" And they're like, "Yeah, it's kind of a bummer." And I'm like, like, I could have actually, if I hadn't done the whole money-making scam part, I could have disseminated and gotten them into Scientology, right? Even knowing I'm a critic. So it's been kind of amusing to me that I've been able to do that and talk about it in such a way that I can appeal to people's emotion, right? I get an emotional appeal and put that carrot out there and get them to want it. So it's not necessarily hard, but you do have to make that connection with the person. And if they fail to make that connection, or the person has resistance to that, then they're not going to fall for it. And that's pretty much what it comes down to. Hamish Downey: "If Thetans don't have a gender, then why was Ron Hubbard so anti-homosexuality? I realize that Ron is a product of his time, and there are documentaries I've watched that say he was anti-homosexuality because of his son. But I guess my question is a larger one. In Christianity, souls also don't really have a gender. The same for angels. And yet, homosexuality is a big issue there. To me, logically, if what we all truly are is a spiritual being, and that being doesn't have a gender, why would it matter to any religion that two spiritual beings choose to love each other, whatever gender their bodies take form? While the question is coded in terms of Scientology, I'm really more asking you as a critical thinker for your opinion on this." This is a good question. It addresses the broader issue, because I think I last week or the week before I talked about Hubbard's homophobia specifically. But in a broader context, if you look at, like, if we go back to say the Bible, right, or the Torah, or these early religious works, right? I'll look at homophobia or anti-homosexuality in terms of religious belief, because I think that's where a lot of it comes from. And you have this creationism. You have this creation tale of Adam and Eve, you know, not Adam and Steve. And you have a lot of rules and regulations that are laid out in the Bible that are based really on tribal survival, right? Very primitive forms of survival, the shellfish thing, a lot of the dietary restrictions and whatnot that come that the Jewish people have and that, you know, they move forward, come from keeping people alive in areas where if they were eating this food or doing some of these practices, they were found by, you know, empirical observation to kill people, right? So they didn't want to do that. And I think just kind of logically a little bit that they would probably be, you know, these primitive people were probably looking at homosexuality and saying, well, there's no babies. And that's a problem, right? And so we're going to restrict that, okay? There's also, and I don't pretend to know where this comes from, but I don't think it's a total education point. There is in some people, not everybody, but in some people, there is a sort of an instinctive or gut level reaction against homosexuality, homosexual practices, revulsion toward it, right? And I don't think that's, my opinion is that that's not always a taught response, that's not always a response that comes through education. And again, I think that goes back to a reproductive instinct that we have as animals. But I think the intolerance that comes from that is taught, if that makes sense. I think that you can overcome those instinctive sort of reactions, especially now in a modern age, especially where we're not at all concerned about, making babies anymore. We got 8 billion people on this planet. We don't need to be concerned about the need to, you know, keep reproducing. So I think that's kind of where some of these ideas come from. And of course, you know, with religious restrictions, you're tying these practices into the idea with people that you're indoctrinating them that it's holy, it's connected to God now, or gods. And when you make those connections, now if you violate those rules or restrictions, you're not just threatening the person's immediate life, you're threatening their eternal life. And that's a real big deal, right? Whether you believe in eternal life or not, you can see how by threatening, if somebody does believe that and you threaten that, them's fighting words, you know, that's not going to work out well for you. So I think that's where some of that, the indoctrination of that with religion comes in, which has strengthened the homophobia and made that that fight for human rights and civil rights for the LGBTQ community to be that much harder. So that's kind of a summary. There's probably other elements as well that I'm not even thinking of, but those are some of the thoughts off the top of my head. Mea culpa. I'd love to hear more about your recent book signing in LA and how that went for you. I hope it was a success. Also, what's next for Chris Shelton? Any plans for more books? Maybe some fiction? Any burning plans for world domination or even a nice vacation? Well, thanks for the personal interest, actually. I appreciate it. And I do have plans for world domination. But first, the book signing at the Center for Inquiry in Los Angeles went wonderfully. Jamie DeWolf and I spoke, and we had a packed crowd. I didn't realize that the Center for Inquiry was like two blocks away from the Los Angeles Church of Scientology complex, the big blue buildings. We were close. I was like, wow, we're like right over there. And I heard that while it was going on, somebody was out in the parking lot taking license plate numbers down. But that was the only overt action I heard of from Scientology while we were speaking. I think there were a couple people in the audience who were kind of giving me the evil eye. And I think they were from Scientology, but no, none of them spoke up. And we even asked the audience members twice, are there any Scientologists here, right? And nobody, of course, fessed up. Jamie, you know, gave his presentations and talked about L. Ron Hubbard and that sort of thing in his family. And then I went up and spoke, and I spoke about my book and Scientologists. And I tried to talk about how I felt that, that you know, Scientologists in general can sometimes get a very bad rap. be called idiots and morons and, you know, and things like that when they're not. And also to keep in mind that Scientologists in general, the 99% of them, I think, are really good people who are just trying to improve their lives. And they've chosen, you know, to fall for a con artist's scam is what's happening. Chosen or were born into it, right? They didn't all choose. So I was trying to sort of, you know, put a message of tolerance out there for Scientologists in general and the fact that we have work to do to educate those people and get them freed from that cult situation. So that was sort of the theme of my talk. And then we did book signing afterwards. The first time I've ever sat and actually done a bunch of book signing at a table where people were coming up and doing that. It was a lot of fun. Met a lot of great people. Some people I'd only known online before were there. And, you know, and it's a big morale booster for sure to have a bunch of people validating you and validating your work and that sort of thing. So I had a great time. As far as future plans go, there is another book coming this year. I think I've spoken about that on this channel a couple times. And I plan on starting that book in about a month and a half or so. I'm going to spend the second half of this year working on that, kind of like the same way I worked on my first book last year during that time. And I intend on talking about human rights violations, and the Rehabilitation Project Force. And I'm going to talk about that whole subject. And my own experience with it. So I think, you know, I'm hoping that will be well received. And then, yeah, after that, you know, I guess I'd like to say that I consider myself a writer before anything else. You know, I put these videos out every week and I, of course, they're the product of my writing, and I'm a videographer and I do this work, but it all starts from writing, and writing was always my one of my most original goals and dreams for my life and a career path. And when I started working for Scientology, that took a sharp right turn. And then when I stopped working for Scientology, I got right back onto it again. So I'm thinking that fiction works could be in the future as well. There's no reason why not. I've certainly got plenty of ideas. But all this nonfiction work has been because I was, you know, gotten out of Scientology and I needed an outlet to download, and that's that, and writing was it, you know, and this has been very cathartic for me. So as far as vacation and all that sort of thing, yeah, sure, I plan on doing a couple of those as soon as the income is there for that. And I have big lofty goals, you know, actually, for getting a message of critical thinking out there. And I want to move on beyond Scientology to other destructive cults and other destructive groups and that sort of thing. And I'd like to move forward into critical thinking more, popularizing it more. It's a tough sell, though. Critical thinking is not popular. And people really, you know, you start talking about critical thinking and people's eyes glaze over. You know, and you can see the views on my channel of critical thinking videos versus Scientology videos. You know, they don't compare. And my podcast as well, right? I want to keep working on that because I think that there's a broader message. There's broader messages to be gotten out with that, and I hope to figure that out so that does become more popular and more widespread, and I can have a positive effect on people's lives out there. And not just talk about Scientology forever, because that's sort of a negative. You know, it's like, yes, this exists, it's bad, stay away from it. And I'm happy to answer questions about it and talk about its abuses, but I'd like to move over into a popular, or not popular, but positive message too. And I'm still figuring out what that could be or is or should be, and maybe it's not just one thing, maybe it's a number of things. And that's what I'm sort of working on with my podcast and with future books and whatnot that I'll put out, because it's not, I guarantee you, I have more than two Scientology books in me as a writer. So those are some plans I have. Gabe Newell, how much did you pay to the church when you were there? When I was a public for the Church of Scientology, when I first started doing services, I paid $900 for the first three courses that I did, which was the professional TRS course, the student hat course, and the Hubbard Qualified Scientologist course. that was a special package that they were doing for $900, and ooh, big deal, right? And the professional TROS course was that first high level communications course that I took, and then the student had, of course, was study, and the HQS course was a broad overview of a lot of Scientology basics and fundamentals, and I did them in that order, which is sort of the backwards order from how most people would have done them. Then I did an ethics course, and I think that was like, you know, $200 or $300. And I did an e-meter course, and that was a couple $100. And then I did the purification rundown, and that was like $1,800 or something. And so after that, I joined staff, and I never paid for services after that because I was a staff member and I, you know, worked for it. And then when I left, and then I joined the C organization, of course, and then I didn't pay for services there either. Paid for materials, but not services. And then when I left the C organization, I was given a freeloader's bill. But because, you know, as a staff member, I moved up to the C org, so they weren't going to charge me for any of that. I'd fulfilled my contract as far as that was concerned. So that was where the bulk of my Scientology services happened, was when I was on staff. That's when I went up to CLEAR, the state of CLEAR, and I got a lot of auditing and stuff. When I went into the Sea Org, I didn't really do much Scientology as far as the auditing goes or the bridge goes. I did a lot of auditing, sorry. I did the RPF, I did a lot of FPRD, I did a lot of sec checks, I did, you know, some other kind of auditing, but I didn't move up that bridge to total freedom. And so when I left the Sea Org, I didn't have this gigantic freeloader's bill where that you have to pay back for services that you received, because most of the services I received were some classes and not a lot of auditing. So that was a few $1,000s, and I did pay that, and I, you know, I could look back and I might as well have, I wish I hadn't, you know, I basically threw that money into a fireplace and burned it. But that's that was my monetary contribution to Scientology. I mean, I donated a few, you know, $100 here and there. But my contributions to Scientology were my time and energy and years of my life, much more than it was monetary. And that's, there you go. Captain Jax. I'm a never in, but I'm intrigued by the cult and its strange activities. I watch Scientology videos and I hear about brain pills that someone said were by all the water fountains. Do you have knowledge of these? Were they pep pills like caffeine or ephedrine? Did the cult have any other strange rituals or activities that are not publicly known about? Please let us know more about what's behind the curtain. So I think what you're talking about here has to do with getting sessionable, okay? When you're going to go in for... and by the way, no, there's no pep pills by the water fountains. I don't even know, you know, what that is. But here's what I'm thinking is where this comes from. When you're going to go in session in Scientology, you hold the cans, and when you go in session, you're supposed to be well-rested and well-fed. And you're not supposed to have any distractions by being hungry or being tired. And if you are hungry or tired, then they're not supposed to audit you. So there's a check that they do using the e-meter when you go into an auditing session. And you're sitting there and you hold the cans. And what they do is you have to take a deep breath and you hold it for just a moment and then you let it out through your mouth. And that's supposed to register on the meter with a fall. The needle's supposed to, you know, crash over. And that indicates that you're well rested and well fed. Now, that's whatever, but that's the test that they use. And if it doesn't do that, then they say, regardless of what you have to say about it, they'll say, well, we can't do a session right now because you're not... your metabolism is not up to showing that you're well-rested and well-fed. And so oftentimes what will be done is the person will go and get some food or some vitamins or a whole panoply of nonsensical things to handle their lack of metabolism passing, right? Their test, the metab, that's called a metab test or a metab, right? And if they don't metab, then they can't go in session. So they'll go take bee pollen or vitamins or minerals or liquid vitamins or juice or, you know, milk or something, right? And eat some food, anything they can do to pump up the energy in their body so that they can pass this metab check. And there was, you know, one amusing day I'll tell you about where I was on the RPF and we were near the end and I was not metabbing no matter what. I mean, I was sitting there and I was taking a deep breath and letting it out and over and it just wasn't happening. And I'd go off and I'd get some vitamins or I'd get some bee pollen or I'd eat some Snickers, I'd eat a protein bar or, you know, anything I could do, drink a lot of water, run around. I was running up and down the stairs trying to get it to digest faster, you know, so I could get back on the cans and pass this stupid metab check. And we spent all day trying to get me on the meter and it wouldn't go. And finally they gave me this concoction. I don't know what it was, like drinking vomit. I mean, it was awful. It was like vinegar and oil and this green stuff. I mean, it was so nasty. Oh God. And I had to drink this stuff. And I couldn't even drink the whole thing down. None of it was doing a thing for me. I must have had like 3 or 4 shake, you know, protein shakes and stuff. Like I was stuffed. And finally we solved it because, you know, I was in this kind of deep chair and I finally sat up straight. I'd been sitting like this. And so I sat up like this and bam, right? The needle goes over and it was all cause I wasn't sitting straight, you know? So, that was a little annoying that day. So that's kind of some of the nonsense Scientologists get up to. Hey, it's time for some flash answers. Reed Adams. My brother has been in Scientology since 1971 as a worker bee for the organization in exchange for auditing and other church services. He is married and living in a Scientology-owned apartment with another couple. My question is, does Scientology provide retirement benefits, housing, health care, end-of-life, palliative care, etc. for its work staff? Or are they even allowed to retire? No, none of that is given to Scientologists who work for Scientology. They're all considered volunteers, and their time by contract is not remunerated for or exchanged for in any way or obligation from the church. Jonathan Mark, can the person being audited see the needle on the e-meter? If he is clever, can he control the needle by tightening or relaxing his grip on the cans? No, they cannot see the needle on the dial. The meter is put in such a position that the pre-clear, the person being audited, can't see it. And yes, if he's clever, he can use his hands or body to affect what the needle is doing. Auditors are trained to watch for what are called body motion reads or body reactions. And there are, and when you know how to read a meter, you can see those. Like you can see somebody trying to manipulate the meter most of the time, but not all the time, not by any stretch of the imagination. And yes, you can fool it. Amanda Burke, do Thetans occupy animals? They can, at least according to what some Scientologists believe. They're cats and they're dogs. Oh, there's a Thetan there. Oh yeah, I can see you look in their eyes. There's a Thetan there. So, sure. Rafaela Hasbeen. Hi, Chris. Does the Church of Scientology pay property taxes on all of their real estate? Nope. Not in the United States they don't, because that's what it means to be tax exempt, is they don't have to pay taxes, and that very much includes property taxes. So any country where the Church of Scientology has tax exemption, they are not paying property taxes. Okay, folks, so we've reached the end of our critical Q&A episode for this week. Thank you very much for coming around. If you have any comments, feedback, or questions for me, put them in the comments section of this video or send them to me by email. I see them all. I'm happy to look at them and put them in the queue and get to them as quickly as I can. And I really appreciate you guys coming around and watching, and I will see you next week. And I will put one little plug in here that if you are enjoying or getting anything out of what I'm doing on a regular basis, I would ask that you please consider supporting me on Patreon, because that's actually what enables me to continue doing this work. And it does help, and it does make a difference every little bit. So thanks a lot, and I'll see you guys next week.